May it please the court, good morning. This case is about the authority of a trial court to enter a clarification order on what we contend is an unambiguous decree. Let me start by giving a brief background, although I'm sure your honors are familiar with the facts, the basic facts that were established at the trial of this case and aren't disputed on appeal, which makes this a rather nice package for a legal dispute to be decided in this case, is that Mr. Murray sells Ameriplan's products, which is discount health insurance, dental and vision plans. He also recruits brokers to sell those products. And if brokers he recruits sells them, he makes a commission just as if he had sold them, except it's slightly lower the farther down the downline goes. It's a multi-level marketing plan. And the basic thing I want the court to understand is about the way the commissions are paid. No one disputes that Mr. Murray makes a commission only upon payment of a monthly premium, meaning if he sells a plan to a customer, that customer pays the $20 initial fee or $19.95 for that month, he makes a commission. The next month, that customer does not pay his premium, no commission. It's a month-to-month plan. So it's clear, we believe from the record, that the commissions are earned upon the payment of the premiums. Now, turning to the original decree, August 4, 2003, the court heard arguments on this one issue, and that was how to divide this, quote, residual income Mr. Murray may or may not receive on these commissions. At the end of the trial, there was two questions. One, should she order some sort of payment in the future, or two, should she value this business or book of business that Mr. Murray and she had generated during marriage? The court refused to value the book of business or the customers or the brokers that were in Brad's downline as of the date of divorce, and instead, and I quote, stated, I'm going to award Ms. Murray 60% of the residual income to be received in the future of the portion of his commissions that were earned during marriage. And we believe that that is the unambiguous oral rendition of a judgment, later reduced to writing, that clearly uses the magic words in community property, family law in Texas, that Ms. Murray was entitled to 60% of the commissions earned during marriage. The only logical, at this point, interpretation of that is that for all the premium payments that had been made as of the date of divorce, on which Mr. Murray was entitled to a commission, whether he got paid for those commissions in the following month or two as his check came in, she was entitled to. Later, the court reduced this to writing on October 9, 2003, but made the divorce decree effective as of the date of her oral rendition. And in it, she used a couple phrases I think have become a little bit a bone of contention in this case. One is she used the phrase business generated prior to August 4, 2003, which is the date of divorce. The trial court also used the phrase based on the book of business as of August 4, 2003. And we believe when you combine that language with the unambiguous oral rendition, it's clear that the court was talking about the way Mr. Murray was paid, and that's based on payments made as of the date of divorce, which in turn means that's the commissions he had earned during marriage. We believe that's unambiguous. We believe it's the only reasonable interpretation. Appellee has contended that because two terms weren't defined or the phrases weren't defined, the decree is ambiguous. The case law does not bear that out. Undefined terms get their plain meaning, and of course, when you look at the divorce decree as a whole, as well as what was at issue here, book of business and business generated as of a certain date, can be given one legal meaning. Therefore, it's not ambiguous. Furthermore, appellee contends that we're looking outside the divorce decree by looking back to the trial court's oral rendition on August the 4th, 2003, but we contend that that's not looking outside the decree, that in fact is the court's judgment. As we know, the Supreme Court has stated in a case that's not in our brief, Common Aluminum v. Dibrell, which is at 450 Southwest 2nd, 56, it's a 1970 Texas Supreme Court case, which has been followed numerous times following that. It says that an oral rendition, an unambiguous oral rendition, controls over the written judgment. So it would be odd indeed if we were here, for instance, on a nunc pro tunc argument, and this court would actually give controlling weight to the oral rendition, But when we're trying to determine what the court actually ruled to determine whether the decree was ambiguous, for the court not to look at the oral rendition on the actual date the court made its judgment. So we believe when you combine the language of the decree in paragraph 13, which we cited in our brief, and it's actually on page 9 in appendix 2, I believe, and the actual rendition, which is on page 62 of volume 3 of the reporter's record, regarding that earned during marriage, we believe that the decree is unambiguous and can only be given one reasonable legal interpretation.
Hey, let's back up for a minute. When she said, I'm going to award Mrs. Murray 60% of the residual income to be received by Mr. Murray in the future of the portions of his commission that were earned during marriage, how is that not ambiguous? One part she's saying in the future, the second part she's saying that were earned during marriage, which is in the past.
Your Honor, I believe that Licata v. Licata and numerous other cases covers that. That deals with situations where something's earned during marriage and paid later. Okay. There's no doubt if I get paid.
But you just told me that, as you explained throughout your brief, that it's paid every 30 days. And obviously, it's more than 30 days afterwards here, yes?
A bit of a disconnect there. The premium payments are paid by the members every 30 days.
Yes.
They're paid at different times during the month, and I believe we also cited in our brief testimony was he gets one check for all those payments late. In other words, for all the premiums that were paid in the previous month of, I believe it is July, for instance, he wouldn't receive his check until the middle of August. So, therefore, Ameriplan has to combine all the money for the premium payments paid, and it's sort of like an employee that works 2 weeks, and then the employer pays them on a two-week delay. The case law is clear that it doesn't matter when you pay the person. He's going to get that money after the date of divorce. I think the court was trying to make clear that if he has checks trickle in from commissions that were actually earned during marriage, she's not cutting her off of all money August 4th. She's using the magic language that if you earn it during marriage, it doesn't matter when it's paid. I don't think she's saying commissions earned after August 4th, 2003 is the residual income. I believe that the key phrase there is the portion of his commissions that were earned during marriage. And if we get into whether or not it's ambiguous, I will argue, just conceding for a moment that it's ambiguous. And we get to the argument of how are you going to construe it? Are you going to construe it the way Appelli likes or the way we like? Well, by getting in the door for a clarifying order, they had to argue it was ambiguous. That's a concession that there's more than one reasonable legal interpretation of the judgment.
And so your client's position is the way the trial court defined group A, B, or C, your client's position is that wife would have no right to those defined groups A, B, or C, correct?
The way the court defined A, B, and C, I believe all three groups in the clarifying order deal with things earned after marriage, so it would be obviously separate property. That's the argument. The clarifying order wasn't necessary, and when it, not only did the court err by entering a clarifying order, it proceeded to enter a clarifying order that tacked on additional groups of people that came, commissions and people even, that came long after the date of divorce.
You're so not disputing that she's entitled to 60% of the commissions that were earned during marriage, regardless of when they're paid. You're not disputing that.
Absolutely not.
You're only disputing what is earned after the marriage is over.
That's right. And I think
that's where. Okay, that's
what. Yes, Your Honor. And the dispute, I believe, the nub of it, if we get past whether it's ambiguous, and I was going to comment that if you concede it's ambiguous, and you have on one hand an interpretation that awards Ms. Murray commissions earned after marriage, and one interpretation that's reasonable, if I don't concede it's reasonable, but if Your Honors think maybe it's reasonable, maybe you can get there, that awards her commissions earned after marriage, according to Shanks and a few other cases, numerous, you have to adopt the interpretation that complies with the law. And we believe the only one of those interpretations that complies with the law is the one that determines when are these commissions earned, question one. And then you can only give her the ones that were earned during marriage. And that basically leads me to my second point about when are these commissions actually earned. There's a, I believe, once again, a disconnect in the way that Appelli characterizes the way these commissions are earned. The way I see the Appelli's position is It's based on people. In other words, he gets credit for bringing in people, and since people were brought in during marriage, any commissions earned as a result of the work of those people, Ms. Murray should get credit for. But in fact, no one disputes, it's in our statement of facts, unrefuted, and the trial testimony was undisputed as well. The only way Mr. Murray makes a dime, he could recruit the entire city of Fort Worth to be his brokers and the entire city of Fort Worth to be his members. If they don't make a payment on a monthly basis, he gets no money. So, and I believe that the Cunningham case is, while not 100% on point, it's pretty close. In that case, these insurance policies were actually sold during marriage, renewable insurance policies, and the wife argued that she should be entitled to a percentage of the commissions he made on the renewal of those insurance policies. And the court, Dallas Court of Appeals, held that when the commissions were earned was when the renewal premium was paid, because before it was paid, he got, the insurance agent received no income whatsoever. Not only was it not, was it an expectancy, it wasn't even an expectancy until it was actually paid. This court followed Cunningham's logic, as well as a few other cases in Loiza. And I think Loiza is an important case here, because Loiza had another element that this case actually has, and that is, what does the person have to do post-divorce to be entitled to them? Not only are these commissions not earned during marriage, but Mr. Murray has to remain a broker for Ameriplan and sell a policy a month in order to be entitled to get these commissions. So it's actually, they're earned after marriage, and he's got to continue to be an employee and sell a policy. In Loiza, the money was guaranteed. The contract for that pit for Esteban Loiza was guaranteed so long as he actually was willing to perform his services after marriage ended. And the wife argued, listen, this is a guaranteed contract. It was signed during marriage. He's going to get this money. He negotiated it. It's based on all the good pitching he did up until the time he signed the contract. And this court said, not only would the money not be earned during marriage, but it's for personal services that would be performed the next year after marriage. And this court said he only had to be willing to perform his services, because in that case, as we know from major league contracts, it's guaranteed, meaning if they cut him or if he gets injured, he still gets his money. So he just has to say, I'm here, I'm ready, let me pitch. He gets his money. In this case, Mr. Murray didn't just have to be willing to perform services for Ameriplan. He actually had to perform services and sell a policy a month to remain active. So you have the Cunningham angle, where that insurance agent just had to remain an active broker. He didn't have to sell any policies. And you also have the Loiza angle, where he had to continue to perform services post-divorce. That, combined with the fact that he's not even entitled to a dime if no one makes their payments after marriage, clearly, I think, shows that they were earned, that these commissions in A, B, and C group that Justice Livingston alluded to are earned after marriage, because the payments are made after marriage. And it was a mistake to tie what Ms. Murray's entitled to actually the people in the group. The definition of book of business that Apelli puts forth says everybody that's in his downline constitutes the book of business. And so any payments they ever make, forever and ever, they stop paying, then they start again, Ms. Murray's entitled to. And that, of course, leaves off the fact that they're not earned until they actually make the payments, whether it's 10 years later or 4 years later as now. And it also omits the fact that he was required to remain an active broker and also sell a policy a month. So for those reasons...
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose instead of a salesman, he were a doctor and had built a practice. And suppose the judge were dividing the value of the practice. Do you not contemplate the business he'll do in the future in valuing the business?
Yes, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals addressed something similar to that in a psychological counseling business. And what the court said there was, you're free to divide the personal property, you're free to divide goodwill, you're free to divide, value the business and divide it, but you cannot give the divorcing spouse a percentage of the future income to be earned, even if it's patients that were developed during the marriage. So there's a distinct line, and in fact, it was proffered to the court in this case to value it. And Ms. Murray, in the record, explicitly rejected any valuation. She wanted a continued income stream of a percentage of future commissions. And the court said, okay, I won't value it. Here's what I'm going to order. And we believe that's the unambiguous language that we talked about. And in Butler, it was almost ipso facto, you can't do that. It wasn't even a question of whether you could give the ex-wife future income from those patients that were developed. They might even had bookings as of the date of divorce. But until they actually, the doctor saw the patient, and this is an example of the paid when earned, commissions earned or paid. Had the doctor seen the patients during marriage, but they hadn't paid their bill until after marriage, I believe, of course, she would be entitled to that. I see my time is up, so if you don't have any more questions, I'll sit down.
Please, the Lord. I'm Mark Snyder. I'm representing Karen Murray in this matter. There are basically three issues in this. First is the decree of divorce ambiguous, and the second and third are intertwined. Was there evidence before the court from which Judge Worley could determine that, determine or reach the clarification that she did? I think the decree itself is clearly ambiguous because it is filled with terms in there that are not referenced, not defined, and are not terms of common usage. The residual income is used throughout book of business. So from looking at the decree itself, it cannot be determined from the four corners of the decree what those terms mean. So next we have to look at the record, and at that point the decree is ambiguous. If we look at the language used by the statements from the judge, we will find that the judge's part of the problem in this is that this income stream we're talking about, numerous different terms are used to describe it throughout the proceedings. It is at one point called residual income. It is sometimes referred to as commission, override, even the principal of Ameriplan, the company generating the with whom the independent contractor relationship exists, refers to it as residual income. The question then is, in looking at the court's own language in its rendition, is what did the court mean by earned during the marriage? It's our position that the term earned during the marriage is, again, vague because we are looking solely at income produced by sub-brokers or downstream brokers. We are not looking at income from membership sales made by Mr. Murray personally. And the only thing Mr. Murray does during the course, after he obtains those brokers, he has no further duty towards those brokers, and he is not doing anything else. He earns the right to the broker income, the sub-broker downstream income, during the course of the marriage. The income is generated by the downstream brokers after the marriage, but his right, his contractual rights, are generated during the marriage. Although the judge, in the initial trial at the close of it, used the language we've talked about, there is a second hearing that takes place where they are, where they go over this issue again and again. Again, we interchangeably see the use of residual income, downstream income. Interestingly enough, during that we don't see the use of the term commissions. We then have to go. So I think clearly it is ambiguous, and there's evidence in the case from which the trial judge can look and say this will support that supports the trial judge's ultimate interpretation. Now, and remember, we have, it's not whether there is contradictory evidence, it is there evidence to support the trial judge's interpretation.
If we are unable to determine what the judge meant for the numerous reasons that you've articulated, why is not the proper thing to do to remand it for clarification from her as to what she meant?
If I'm understanding, Your Honor, correctly, the judge has already ruled that in the clarification order. I'm not sure that it's appropriate. She has said what she meant, and through the interpretation of the order. So I do not believe that remand is the appropriate remedy.
All right, let me ask you another question. It seems to me that the way that your client is entitled to future income is that she's awarded a portion of a business. If this was a corporation or a partnership and she gets 30% of it, then she owns 30% of the business and she's entitled to 30% ad nauseum because she's got 30% of the business. So it seems to me that what we're really being asked is this a business that she's awarded a portion of, 60%, or is this a series of independent jobs that occur which are separate property after they're no longer married and obviously were community property while they're married? No?
Rather than describing it as a business, I would describe it as contract rights that are created during the marriage. Similar to contract rights that can be created in a stock option, similar to contract rights that can be created in retirement benefits or employee benefits. And as we've said in our brief, if you look at the sum total of rights, contract rights, the ability that they have to make use of this income stream, these overrides, then we go far beyond the language in Cunningham of the mere expectancy. This is a right that could be sold, it could be given, it could be transferred at will, it could be used to borrow money. The rights continued after the independent broker arrangement left into retirement. And unlike in Cunningham, the Cunningham case, Ameriplan couldn't terminate this relationship at its option. The broker had to meet these very limited sales quota. And again, unlike in Bybrock, which came out of this Court of Appeals, Mr. Murray had no duty to continue to service these downstream brokers. So there is a significant difference between Cunningham and Bybrock. To take it out of an expectancy with all these valuable contract rights.
And is that your position, that that's one of the distinctions between this case and Eliza as well?
Eliza, first of all, although the language guarantee was used in the contract, that court looked at the specific rights under that contract. It did not look at the language guarantee. It did not, just as we're saying, you should not just look at the title commission. Instead, it looked at the rights under that contract and said, these rights are to protect them in the event of injury, in the event of a future termination. They're not for, and they are earned through conduct that takes place after the marriage. These rights, other than to sell one membership a month, Mr. Murray has no further duty towards to service these downstream brokers. He only has the right to the income, the future income. He earned that right during the course of the marriage. The contract rights came in existence during the course of the marriage. So that it became community because of that. That's when the rights came into existence.
This exhibit to the clarification order, is that really the first time that we identified all the downstream people that the Plan A actually attached to?
I think that that may have been presented into evidence during the trial. Unfortunately, due to the period of time between the trial and the clarification hearing and the appeal, the exhibits have been lost or disposed of. But my understanding is that there was identification of these individuals during the course of the during the course of the original trial. But I would have to look back and go through the recorder's record in detail.
How did you come up with attachment one then? Was that proved up at the clarification hearing, one of the hearings?
It is my understanding that it was.
Are there no cases like concerning a royalty on a song, some sort of music? I mean, it seems to me that's kind of what this is. Somebody's awarded a percentage interest in the royalty of a piece of music, and the person that wrote the song or performed the song is entitled to a royalty down the road without doing anything else. Seems to me that cases shouldn't be too difficult, and that's kind of what you're arguing that it is. The work has already been performed, and there's going to be an income stream generated by the work already performed, and that's what she's been awarded.
I am not aware of any. I did not come across any in my research. So my understanding is that if the songs and the royalties would be community property if the agreements were entered into relating to that during the marriage. But I have not researched it on the issue of royalty, so I would be very reluctant to make a firm representation to the court as to that. But I think the key in this is to look at the contract rights in comparison to the rights in Cunningham, the rights in Vibrot, and we see that these contract rights go far beyond the mere expectancy as described in Cunningham. And instead, with all the rights to transfer, to will, to give, none of which are identified or discussed in Cunningham or Vibrot, it clearly moves this beyond a mere expectancy and something that can be awarded as community property. Because the contractual relation comes into existence during the course of the marriage, it should be treated as community property. And that is when it is earned by Mr. Murray through obtaining these contract rights with these sub-brokers.
Except that he has to continue working there and get at least one. This isn't like a royalty from an oil well or royalty from a piece of music. There are certain things that he has to do to continue to receive these.
Most certainly.
It's
my understanding that is a nominal action. At this time, Murray or the community or whoever you want to say, had in excess of, I believe it was between 800 and 1,000 brokers. That is a nominal action. And again, if we look at other community property cases involving retirement benefits, employee benefits, stock options, the courts have held in those cases that even if he can forfeit those rights through termination of employment, a party can forfeit those rights through termination of employment or the relationship, that does not defeat the community nature of those interests. We believe that that's an appropriate analogy to this. These rights in the future income, when taken in light of all the contract rights involved with it. Based on that, we believe it's appropriate for the court to uphold the ruling of the trial court and to confirm the clarification order, and would ask the court to do so.
Is there any evidence in the record about things that he has to do as part of, or does do as part of this business, such as servicing his brokers, communicating with them, giving answers to questions, trying to get them to develop more people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in the record?
Absolutely, Your Honor, at trial. The question is whether he has to. Well, he has to make money.
Well, that's what I mean.
Well, there was a testimony, and this goes to your question, Justice McCoy, about whether it's a business. First of all, it's clear the court did not divide it as a business. It's clearly a payment of his income like someone would award. So the court didn't treat it that way. But secondly, there was testimony that he had his overhead structure, which wasn't taken into account in the divorce decree, by the way, was about 40% for travel, phone calls, and all the other things he does and the meetings he has to service his brokers. With a 40% overhead structure, I mean, you've got to be doing something to build your business. Secondly, I wanted to point out one mistake. It's not that someone has to sell a policy in his downline to remain active. He has to pay his dues, remain in good standing, pursuant to the rules and procedures of Ameriplan, and sell one policy a month, which is much more than the insurance agent had to do in Cunningham. Also, going to Justice Livingston's distinction regarding Loaiza, her question regarding Loaiza, the underlying question in every stock option case, the Loaiza case, the bottom line is the court needs to pinpoint when the commission payment income is actually earned. Contract rights, of course the contract rights vested during marriage in Loaiza. He signed a guaranteed contract during marriage. He's got contract rights. The question is, when did he earn the money? This court said he didn't earn the money until he showed up on day one of the season of the contract willing to perform his services. Therefore, it doesn't matter when your contract right vests, it's when you earn the money. I believe whether there's contracts are signed during marriage is a red herring unless there's some money earned on that contract during marriage. Also,
will you agree that the trial court must have considered the language that we discussed earlier to be ambiguous, or we wouldn't have had a clarification order?
Well, I wanted to point that out. Regarding my findings of fact and conclusions of law, I didn't want to belabor it because I'm not sure how I was harmed since the issues have been joined so clearly, and the reason for findings of fact is so I don't have to guess, and I think I just guessed right based on appellee and the way the court has gone. But the problem is that the statute, and some of them kind of talk about it in a jurisdictional language. There's some case law out there that talks about there's no power of the court to enter a clarification order if they don't find it's ambiguous. Well, the court didn't orally find it. The court didn't find it in its clarification order. And, of course, she refused to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law. So we don't really have a finding under a Texas Family Code 9.007 and 8 regarding a finding, assuming, as I believe Your Honor is, that she must have found it was ambiguous because there weren't definitions. I'll give you that, but if it's jurisdictional, I'm not sure I can concede that. I'm not sure that matters if I concede it, but I believe she thought that the lack of definitions made it ambiguous.
And what deference do you think that we give to her determination that it was ambiguous?
None. Constructions of divorce decrees are de novo. It's a matter of law. The fact is that once you get to whether there are multiple reasonable interpretations and they all comply with the law, I believe then Your Honor could say, she was the trial judge, that's reasonable, it complies with the law, she can make that determination. Of course, our point is that any interpretation that awards money earned after marriage doesn't comply with the law, and so the court should reject that interpretation. I wanted to point out one other thing about the royalty question. There are cases on royalties. In fact, in the clarification hearing, Ms. Murray relied on a case called Alsens v. Alsens, which was a case in which the court held that patents were earned during marriage, the royalties in the future. But they distinguished stock options, retirement benefits, and other of the like, and said, listen, we just want to know when it was earned. And since everything was done during marriage, and then the money just flows in, you don't have to do anything or whatnot, Your Honor was correct. And that case is just one example. They haven't relied on that case in this court, and I think the reason is because that court clearly makes a distinction between when things are earned, and in this case, I think these commissions are earned after marriage. One last point about Group C. Even if you find that she was giving a book of business that existed as of August 4th, 2003, which was that downline in that exhibit, the Group C category goes a step further. It's actually Now, it's not a book of business. It basically tortures the language because it's not a book of business existing as of that date, which is actually the language the court used. And Ms. Murray, actually, her attorney conceded that on page 17 of volume 5 of the reporter's record and said, so what you're saying is we don't get any growth after that date. I see my time is up.
Go ahead,
finish my answer.
Sentence.
The fact is that Group C actually awards not just that group of people that were in existence on August 4, 2003, but everybody knew those people sign up and all the commissions generated from those people. So at the very least, if your honors adopt book of business means a group of people as of a certain date, the court should follow the record and choose this interpretation, however unreasonable I may think it is, and not include the growth after the date of divorce.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, your case is submitted, and after y'all retire, we'll call the next case.